almost all of my work, even like my short stories, everything kind of deals in some way with like the first generation experience. Like that's a really defining part of who I am. The fact that my parents, like I serve as a bridge between the culture I come up in and the culture that my parents come from, which is like kind of mythical in some ways, the stories they tell me. I mean, everyone has parents who tell them like, I walked uphill both ways, you know, whatever. But I think when your parents have like a thick accent and come from a country where you've never seen, like, are there, how do hills work? You know, like you start to really, it feels a lot more magical kind of, I think. So I think everything I write is somewhat negotiating that. And I think with Daughters of Odumah, I really did lean into, so Daughters of Odumah is written in a pigeon voice. So it takes place on this island where there's no adults and these kids live in little tribes. And the tribe it focuses on is like a tribe of girl wrestlers. They compete in this like divine martial arts tournament. And they speak in a pigeon. All the kids on this island speak in a pigeon. And for me, that was very much like trying to express how my culture sounds to me. You know, I don't have a fluent ear for Nigerian pigeon, but I do recognize it and I can kind of utilize it. And so I was like, I want a book that sounds like how my parents sound, you know, like that sounds like how my household sounds. There, you know, there's not a lot of books like that. So that was kind of the impetus there. And Lies is more like me trying to channel my dad's storytelling. It's, you know, my dad's a big time storyteller. My mom's a librarian. She loves books. My dad is like carries the oral tradition and a lot of our cultural history. And so a lot of my childhood was spent with him just telling us, as I get older, probably false stories, but like these really grand, you know, that's the good part of having kids. You can lie to them. They don't know. But like, these just really grand, amazing stories of my grandfather and the places he grew up and the things he did and how he met my mom and all these like interesting stories from a land I'd never been to. And so a lot of the Forever Desert, I think, is kind of infusing his voice in the sense of like that his voice being my connection to the African continent, being my connection to Nigerian culture.
What is up, everybody? You're listening to episode 94 of SFF Addicts. I'm your host, Adrian M. Gibson, and welcome to your weekly dive into the world of science fiction, fantasy, and writing craft. Joining me, as always, is my co-host, the Chewie to my Han Solo, the Joker to my Commander Shepard, MJ Kuhn. How's it going, MJ?
Hello, I am doing great. How are you?
Doing fantastic today. And I just want to say some nice things about my friend, because she has great books, and you can go buy them right now, including Among Thieves, The Little Blue Baby, and Thick Ass Thieves, The Green Baby, because that's how I'm going to refer to them now on.
I love it. The Green Baby and the Blue Baby.
Yeah, Blue Babies. If you want some heists and awesome action and fast-paced writing, then MJ is going to hook you up with this duology, and it's complete, so you can pick up both. I highly recommend the combo of hardcover and paperback, because they're
right, then they're actually the same height.
As well, you can check out chapter 2 from my debut novel, Mushroom Blues. The chapter 2 excerpt will be up now as of this recording on FanFi Addict if you want to read that. And that is out on March 19th. As well, a quick note for listeners, the official SFF Addicts Patreon and merch store are live. So check the links in the description to support what we do here. Also, don't forget to rate and review the podcast on your favorite podcast app and subscribe to the FanFi Addict YouTube channel on your where this and every other episode of the show is available in full video. And now, welcoming today's guest, Moses Osei Utomi, author of The Lies of the Ajungo, Daughters of Odumah, and the just-released The Truth of the Eleke. Hello, Moses. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Soon to be released. We got a couple weeks still, but it's coming
when
up.
This goes out, it goes out on launch day.
Oh, we right. We're in the future.
Speaking to the future.
Yeah. Right. Who's president now? I have questions.
It's Thanks Donald Trump, it's excited. Donald Trump, and it's Joe Biden all at the same time, and we're in a fucking time warp.
Oh, no.
It's Donald Biden. Oh, no. Before we dig deeper into the episode, a quick word from our sponsor. Novello is an exciting new publishing and reading platform whose goal is to be the go-to for all things writing and storytelling. Their platform offers an intuitive, user-friendly way for writers to create and share their awesome stories for readers to enjoy, all while maintaining total control over their stories. Everything from the content to cover art and pricing is all controlled by the story's author. Novello also offers social features such as message boards, direct messaging, and a news feed, where you can post updates to your followers. With future plans including support for comics and a marketplace for users to sell other writing-related services, the future of this platform is looking bright. And the best part? It's all available for free. No sign-up fees, no membership, just a growing library of epic tales. Sign up now to bask in the magic of books, where you can enjoy tales like Blackwater, an epic adventure by an award-winning author, or Limbo, The Door Above the Lake, a terrifying battle for survival. Whether you're a casual reader or a professional writer, Novello is the place for you. Visit them at novello.com. That's NOVELO.com. And now, enjoy the rest of this episode of SFF Addicts. All right, buddy. Well, I'm very happy to have you here. Got to know you last year and have read your books and really excited to pick your brain a little bit and hang out. But to start off, we'll just do an introduction. If you could tell listeners and viewers a little bit about yourself and your work.
I can. My name is Moses Ose Otomi. I'm a Nigerian-American author. Almost all of my work is fantasy. I kind of specialize in West African or North African inspired fantasy in some way. I like to say that I try to write fantasy with like psychological thriller elements, depending on who's read my work. I don't know if you'll agree with that, but that's the attempt. I have two books out, or three, since you're in the future. I have Lies of the Ajungo and The Truth of the Aleke. It's part of the Forever Desert trilogy. Those are books 1 and 2. And I also have a young adult fantasy novel called Daughters of Duma, and that sequel, the sequel to that one, will be coming out in 2025.
Nice, man. Yeah. And Daughters of Duma is more like YA kind of leaning, and then The Forever Desert is more like adult leaning.
I think so, yeah. Yeah, I know like the first one it's a little crossovery. Like if you had a 14-year-old, they could probably read it. Mm-hmm. The second one, I won't spoil, but let's keep it to adults probably. Yeah.
I can see that.
Yeah.
Well, like a good comic book, we love origin stories on this show. So can you tell us about your nerd origins? What about the books, TV shows, movies, anything like that really got you into sci-fi fantasy?
Yeah, I think I was born a nerd. I'm sure like if you have pictures of me like 3 days I'm doing something embarrassing. I think so fantasy, I kind of had like two entrances into fantasy. One is like a reader and then one is a writer. The reader in me came to it from the Dragonlance Chronicles. So my brothers, for my 13th birthday, they got me Dragons of Autumn, Twilight. I had like read kind of like fantastical things before then, but that was like the first like D&D, Forgotten Realms style fantasy I'd encountered. I was just like, what? Elves and kinder and barbarians? I was tripping out. So I tore through that series, and then I just like Aria Salvatore and Raymond Feast and David Eddings and Robert Jordan and George, like I just tore through everything. Robin Hobb, I was obsessed with Robin Hobb, so, and still am. So that was like my entrance to fantasy as like a nerd geek. And then in my like early 20s, I read The Once and Future King by T.H. White, the Arthurian retelling. And I was just like, this feels different from some of the other stuff I've been reading, but it feels similar. And I was just so fascinated by it and the way it was fantasy, but it was so human. And it was so grounded. And obviously there's a lot of fantasy like that, but it was kind of my first encounter with that type. And then I was like, I need to write this stuff. Like, this is exactly how I want to write it. And then I was just full blown sick with the nerdiness.
And it continues until this day. And you set us up perfectly. That was one of the big moments that convinced you that you wanted to pursue writing more seriously. But how did that unfold over the course of your 20s and until now and until last year when you published kind of like two debuts? Because it was like February, March that you had Daughters of Duma and then the Lies of the Ajungo come out like back to back.
I know.
No pressure.
It was a busy year. Yeah. I'd always been writing. I've always been a writer. But like my parents are Nigerian immigrants, for those who don't know. And for those who don't know, immigrants, especially from Africa, tend to like your kids to have very stable and lucrative jobs. And so creative writing was not at the top of that list, but like, so I thought I'd be a journalist. I thought this is like a writing job that I can tell my parents and they can brag to their friends about. And then I only took my first creative writing class after undergrad. I was a psych major, but then I took a creative writing class after undergrad, and the professor there was like, you know, like writing is a thing. Like you can do it creatively for work and for money. And so he kind of like mentored me and like got me into grad school for it. And then that was where I really met other working writers. Like New York, like, is a place, if anyone hasn't been there, there's like probably 5 writers per square foot of New York land. And so I met all these other writers and I was like, oh, people are doing it. Like, this is a real thing. Real people are doing. And that's when I decided, like, I think I can try to make a run at this. And so it was pretty much from 2015. I graduated grad school in 2015. I was writing, getting rejected for a long time, as we do. And then eventually I wrote Daughters of Oduma and Liza Diadrungo kind of one after the other, pretty quick succession. And things just worked out. But yeah, it took a while before I really realized creative writing could be a career, and then like deciding that's the path I wanted to take. Mm-hmm.
And now your parents can brag.
They do. Yeah.
Oh, hell yeah. They better. Well, you mentioned, you know, your Nigerian heritage a bit. And I just kind of want to talk a little bit about, you know, the ways in which that has influenced your writing and maybe how folklore and history and all of those elements that kind of inspire pieces of your work have inspired the creation of the worlds for Daughter of Oduma and Liza Diadrungo.
Yeah, I think it's almost all of my work. Even like my short stories, everything kind of deals in some way with like the first generation experience. Like that's a really defining part of who I am. The fact that my parents, like I serve as a bridge between the culture I come up in and the culture that my parents come from, which is like kind of mythical in some ways, the stories they tell me. I mean, everyone has parents who tell them like, I walked uphill both ways, you know, whatever. But I think when your parents have like a thick accent and come from a country where you've never seen, like, how do hills work? You know, like you start to really, it feels a lot more magical kind of, I think. So I think everything I write is somewhat negotiating that. And I think with Daughters of Oduma, I really did lean into, so Daughters of Oduma is written in a pidgin voice. So it takes place on this island where there's no adults and these kids live in little tribes. And the tribe it focuses on is like a tribe of girl wrestlers. They compete in this like divine martial arts tournament and they speak in a pidgin. All the kids on this island speak in a pidgin. And for me, that was very much like trying to express how my culture sounds to me. You know, I don't have a fluent ear for Nigerian pidgin. But I do recognize it and I can kind of utilize it. And so I was like, I want a book that sounds like how my parents sound, you know, like this sounds like how my household sounds. You know, there's not a lot of books like that. So that was kind of the impetus there. And Lies is more like me trying to channel my dad's storytelling. It's, you know, my dad's a big time storyteller. My mom's a librarian. She loves books. My dad is like carries the oral tradition and a lot of our cultural history. And so a lot of my childhood was spent with him just telling us, as I get older, probably false stories, but like these really grand, you know, every that's the good part of having kids. You can lie to them. They don't know. But like these just really grand, amazing stories of my grandfather and the places he grew up and the things he did and how he met my mom and all these like interesting stories from a land I'd never been to. And so a lot of the Forever Desert, I think, is kind of infusing his voice in the sense of like that his voice being my connection to the African continent, being my connection to Nigerian culture, like putting that into the series.
That's amazing. Did folklore like come into it at all? Did your dad tell you stories? Obviously he's like, you know, hyping up his life and his dad and all that kind of stuff. But were there folklore or sort of like regional tales that kind of slipped into what he was telling you?
Some, but honestly, I think he kind of repurposed a lot of them to where, and also I probably didn't have full cultural context to understand all of them. So they kind of got jumbled up in my brain in a way that I don't know necessarily what the real story is, but like there's a version that exists in my head. There's a character in the Forever Desert series named Shokolokobango She. It's a long name. I give it in Lies, it's the name of a camel. The name comes up again in Truth in a different context, but that is a character from Nigerian folklore. I don't really know the full story. My dad told me different versions, and sometimes he would use it as a joke when people would ask like what his real name was, because he goes by like an American name. You know, a lot of immigrants will find like an English name, like, oh, it's a real name, and he'll like force people to try to spell it. It's very funny. But yeah, so things like that would bleed in, but I'm not at all like a historian of Nigerian folklore or anything. Yeah.
But that's kind of the best part of it, is especially with oral storytelling, the malleable nature of it when it passes from one person to the next. But also, like, I love the way that you describe it, because it so perfectly exemplifies the fact that a story can befit the narrator as much as it does the story itself. And so it's like the fact that your dad was able to use it for jokes, or the, or use it in reference to himself, and then kind of change it over time, probably depending on like the context, or he was just like, you know, sometimes when I'm reading books like at night to my sons, I'll just like mess around with the shit that's going on the page. Cause I'm like, I've read this like 50 times literally.
Yeah.
And
today it will be different.
Today's going to be different. I'm going to fuck with your head, and you're going to remember in like 20 years and realize I was lying to you.
Right. A lot of that. Yeah.
But I love that. And the, in the Forever Desert, you know, there are two books out so far, and both of them are kind of like in conversation with each other, and oral storytelling is a huge part of it, mostly because the world building that you've done is so rich, and the way that these different aspects of the world are interconnected, despite the fact that Lies of the Ajungo is like less than 90 pages. Truth of the Eleke is like 120, more or less. And so how did you approach world building in this condensed format, and why did you choose to write them both as novellas?
Yeah. I think like, I like novellas a lot. I just think it's a perfect form, honestly. Like, I mean, I've read The Wheel of Time several times, so I'm not knocking big books. They took up most of my life if I'm counting like minute by minute, but like novellas are, it's like the perfect amount of space you need to deliver an effective punch. You know what I mean? Like a novel is a roller coaster. A novella is just the drop. And like, it's perfectly sized. And I love it to deliver. I think of it as like somewhere between poetry and novels, if we're looking at the spectrum of length. And I feel like a novella is the limit of how long you can still get the effect of a poem, kind of. That feeling of the language can be a little more precise and a little more meaningful. And you can really deliver like a gut punch right at the end, right? As opposed to like a novel, this traditional structure, you have like the denouement or whatever. I don't know how to speak French. The denouement, as my American mouth says, where like, you know, you have the gut punch of the climax, and then you kind of have like the, and then they went back to the village and they had tea. And remember the fireworks at the beginning, they're back because it's the same celebration from, you know, I don't need all that. Like, you know, the ending of a novella can really do a lot. And so I just love it. And so when I was tackling this world, initially came as just lies. Lies kind of came as its own weird thing that happened in my brain. And I finished it, and I was talking with my editor, Carl, at Tor. And I was just like, you know, we discussed more of them. And I kind of had a sense that if this world is going to come into being, like, I need to be able to see the whole thing, like the whole thing. And so it didn't. But I also knew that like any snippet of this world, I only needed 100 to 150 pages to show you what that part means and how it's connected to the other parts. And so it felt natural as a novella trilogy. And I really, the time jump was really important to me in building the world. I really did want 500 years between these stories so you can really get a sense of the full arc of history.
Yeah. Were there any other challenges that came up from that constrained page count?
Yeah, it was a terrible idea. Immediately, I was like, oh no. Oh no, what have I done?
What have I done?
It's like poetry, but long. Oh fuck, what did I do?
When I started writing, Truth was super hard for me to write. It's the hardest thing I've ever written. I was so like, why did I do this? Like, the point of a sequel is that you've bought some credibility from the audience in terms of they want to see these characters again. They want to follow this journey. And if you've read Lies, we have new characters. And so we have a new journey. And I was like, you know, it's the tyranny of the blank page when you don't have to have it. You could just write a normal sequel and it doesn't have to be there. But I was like, I need to reinvent a world and I need to get the reader invested in it immediately and then go on this journey. So that was a terrible decision, but I hope it's worth it. I think it'll pay off. I'm very happy with how it turned out. And I think it justifies itself very early on. Like very early on, you realize, oh, this is doing something meaningful with this gap in time. But yeah, it was a hassle.
Well, speaking as one reader, I think it definitely paid off. I literally read, I got, we're fancy. We got arcs. But I read my arc of truth in literally a single sitting, because I could not stop reading it. You know, you mentioned the time jump. I want to talk about that a little bit more. Because it is interesting. It was unexpected for me as a reader coming in, going like, ooh, what's going to happen next, you know, in this next book? And then it's, oh, it's all new. It's everything is, but it's, you know, so why, you know, you mentioned it's important to have it set so far after. What was the reason why you definitely wanted to explore that much of a time gap? And can we expect a similar jump for book three?
For the second question, yes. There will be 500 years between book two and book three. For the first question, I think I wanted to like explore mythology in like a way that's fun for me. And I think kind of what I was alluding to earlier about like, you know, in some ways, Nigeria feels like mythology to me, right? It's a place that I know my ancestors are from there. I know there's all these amazing stories that come out of that place, but it feels a little bit mythical. Like, you know, I probably have a better grasp on it than perhaps somebody has no interaction with the culture, but and so when I think of that, I think a lot about like my grandparents and the lives they lived, and like my grandpa grew up pagan, you know, there were no like grew up pre-missionary, you know, the life he had, and then like the idea of he's never been on a plane, the idea of his grandson doesn't speak his language, doesn't worship his gods, his float, you know, done a lot of different things, and I think of how, you know, what is mythology? I think it's very easy to like kind of use that word in a patronizing way. Like we refer to other people's gods as mythological, but our gods aren't, you know? And I'm like, well, what if we got to see, you know, we can do that because we weren't there with Aristotle hanging out and talking about, I don't know if he believed in Zeus or whatever, but you know, like we weren't there with it. So for us, it's just the past. I was like, well, what if we did get to sit there with him? And we did get to see people actively worship and practice things that we think of as like old news and old history. Like, how would that feel? And so I wanted to see, especially Tutu as a character, take him from the human, the real, to the mythological, and not just in like a short-term cultural mythological figure, right? Where like, I don't know, like Bono is like a like mythological, the mythology of Bono. I don't know, but like, in a real way.
I love
like,
how Bono is the example that
I know. I was going to say there's so many options, and we go with Bono. I love it.
You too.
I've never thought of Bono before. That's the first time I've thought of him. And why did it come out?
For all the YouTube fans out there,
right, maybe it's because like the name is short, like Tutu. But I don't know. But I was like, what? Yeah, what does it look like? This little boy that you saw. What does he look like 1,000 years later? Right. After the things he's done are finished, the people who knew him are all gone. And yet his kind of memory remains. What does that look like? And so that was kind of the purpose behind the time jumps.
Yeah. I mean, for me, like what I mentioned earlier about the oral storytelling and how that kind of gets warped and stuff. I think you really accomplished that using the time jump as a way to mythologize Tutu, but also at the same time, kind of like warp the truth that we know based on the story that we read in Lies of the Ajungo. And so it's kind of cool because it's like you're also playing into the notion of tradition and storytelling, but also playing around with concepts of lies and truth, which in both of these books is so big.
Strong, so well and done. Yeah.
I wanted to ask you about that in terms of like why, because I'm just like thinking a lot about this right now in terms of sort of cultural truth and sort of the ways in which people are shaped by the culture that they live in, whether that is propagated through lies or whether that is propagated through personal truths versus like grander truths. So why was truth and lies kind of like such a big thing for you?
Yeah, I think a lot of it was, I mean, I kind of mentioned in the first book acknowledgments that like, I think part of being a first generation person, I mean, if anyone living between two cultures, whether national cultures or subcultures, musical, whatever, like you get to see both sides and you realize they're both wrong and they're both right. You know, like when I see Nigeria covered on the news in America, I'm like, come on, we're not like that. You know what I mean? And then I see America covered on Nigerian news, and I'm like, ah, it's not that simple. And it's, it's, that's just the nature of it. I remember living when I was, I used to live in China, and I was coming back here. I told my friends I was moving back to the States, and they were like, oh, that's sad. Like, are you sure you'll feel safe? And I was like, what? And they're like, I mean, you could get shot. Like, everyone gets shot over there. I remember thinking, like, and this isn't coming from like villagers who just don't know the world. I mean, these, you know, all my friends were educated, they all spoke English. It was just like their sense of America, which makes sense because when you hear about news from a country you're not from, it's almost always bad news. Like, we don't hear the news of when like Kenya's currency rose. We hear when civil war breaks out. And so I was like, yeah, their sense of America is probably very much that like the shootings are constant and everywhere and there's no way to avoid them. And that's not wrong. You know what I mean? It's not right either. It's just, it's way more complicated than that. And so like that tension between factuality and falsehood, when you have people who are isolated from each other, which is, I think the books are trying to play with, it felt so natural. And it's been such a part of my life as a first generation person that I really wanted to explore that.
Yeah, it is. So it is like so wild because I've been going through this exact thing recently just because of all the stuff that's been happening in Ecuador. And
I don't know anything. What is going on? Sorry.
So it's like basically like I can boil it down to like drug cartels and drug gangs have been using Ecuador to funnel cocaine out of Colombia and Peru. And recently, cool. Like we got a new president and his big thing was to just push back against the drug gangs and the cartels and everything like that. But shit just kind of like erupted. And now the government is basically like at war with the drug gangs. But last month is when things got like really bad. And it was like, no one's ever aware, like you said, of the things that are going on in a place unless you're actually immersed in it. Yeah. In which case it's like the beauty and the magic sometimes gets lost right. on the broader public. Like no one's talking about Galapagos or, you know, like good things that have been happening with the Amazon in terms of like its natural rights and stuff like that. But then it's like, boom, shit explodes and there's like cartels and everything and it's all over the news. And it's like when it hits that international media cycle is kind of like what builds people's perceptions of it. And in the States, it's like, oh, what's happening in the States? Your government's fucked up. There's like crazy gun laws and like people are arguing about abortion and all these things that are kind of just like not necessarily in a person's day-to-day life. Mm-hmm. And I think in the Forever Desert, you really capture that well in the sense of like how a character like Tutu is experiencing the world through his own, you know, lens and through the lens of the people around him. And then once he starts to realize like the ways in which the people up on the hill are living versus like the people who are in poverty down below, or how people live out in the desert versus how people live in a city, and the ways in which just reality and perception is so heavily skewed based on what is in front of our eyes versus like what other people tell us, for instance.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think like so much of what we learn is just somebody telling us something, you know, whether it's like somebody like the dude down the street or it's somebody like Anderson Cooper, ultimately, like it's somebody telling us something. And by Anderson Cooper, I mean like whichever billionaire owns CNN.
Whoever so, talked, like,
Bono.
Right. Maybe. Yeah. Whoever talks through him. Sorry, Anderson. I'm sure Anderson is listening. I apologize. You're not a
He's a big fan of the show.
He's an SFF addict.
Yeah. But like, you know, so like, and of course we're humans, we're social creatures, right? You have to put stock in what other people say. When they say there be dragons, you don't need to check for yourself. Trust the dude who just came back from the dragon pit. And so like at the same time, he drinks a lot. There were no dragons. It was just a lizard. You know, it's this, I just love the like intangibleness of truth. Cause I think even if somebody has their best, they're trying to be honest, like they're still colored by their perspective and their upbringing and their background. And so ascertaining the truth is so complicated, and it's been a lot of fun. I mean, despite the enormous stress of trying to put this story together, it was so much fun to play with that. And I was never quite sure what would land on readers, but to hear you guys say like, yeah, you did start to feel when the story itself was manipulating, I was like, yay, you know, that's a good feeling. It took a lot of effort. So I appreciate that.
Yeah, man. Well, on the flip side, I want to talk about something a little bit more tangible, which is action scenes and martial arts. I know you have a background in martial arts. Are you still practicing?
Yeah. Not as much in the last like 2 months because I just moved, but I mean, I grew up moving a lot, bouncing around a lot. I've always been kind of nomadic. And so I would just kind of train whatever martial art was down the street from me. That was just the easiest way I would find it. So I've done a little bit of a lot. I've spent most of my time though in kickboxing and Muay Thai specifically. So yeah, when I'm approaching fight scenes, I just think of it as very psychological and very internal, right? I think like I'm not a Robert Jordan or some of these, especially the like golden age 80s authors who a lot of them served in a war. So they have a very different sense of what battle feels like and they could create the macro. I don't have that sense. For me, fighting is very intimate. It's very personal and it's very fraught with emotion and it's very individual. So that's kind of how I approach them.
I like that distinction you made between the micro and the macro. Cause yeah, it's like a lot of the authors who like were in probably like in the Vietnam War,
right,
had a much more familiar perspective of like macro battles, yeah. Or like Tolkien, who fought in World War I and kind of incorporated that into the Lord of the Rings. But yeah, like talking to you and like Alexander Darwin as well, with his martial arts background, it's so cool to hear about the intimacy of fights and how it almost like turns into a dance. And
it's so much like that.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
Yeah, Alex is, he's next level. He's so good at that. Intimacy is the best word for it, I think. There's something very intimate about it in like a both good and bad way. Like to encounter an enemy and like come to understand them in the way that like you understand a dance partner, right? And like there's things about themselves they reveal because of how they move that they don't intend to. And yeah, it's just, I don't know. It's very intimate and very cool.
Yeah. Well, I think that's a gives you a great perspective for writing the fight sequences, obviously, with all this additional insight. I'm curious, do you have any pet peeves when you're reading action or fight scenes when you see stuff and you're like, come on.
Yeah. Oh, no. Like Hollywood. There's a difference between like, what a real fight looks like and what a fight needs to look like in storytelling. And I accept that 100%. Like I don't make my fights completely real. It's just, that's not what a book is for, right? Like it's not a documentary, it's a fiction novel. So I accept that difference. I think even then though, sometimes there's like the knockout, like spies will just like knock people out and walk away. And I'm like, they're going to wake up. Like they're, nobody's like, they should wake up. Or like you choke people out. Like unless, again, they'll wake up. Like unless you've killed them. That's like just part of, I understand that's just part of storytelling and you just need the person to get from point A to point B and choke somebody out. But
right. And they're a good guy, so they can't kill them. Yeah.
Right. So yeah, you just like put them to sleep for an hour, apparently. As if
that's and they wake up, no brain damage. They're fine.
Exactly. Right. It's like not like writing novels is one of those things where you have to research super strange shit all the time. Mm-hmm. But I was like, what, when you're unconscious, how does the time that you spend unconscious relate to the amount of brain damage that you've received? And it's like, it's not as much time as you think that serious brain damage is occurring. It's like, you're saying, like if you knock someone out and they're not like kind of getting like loopy eyed and coming back to relatively quickly, it's like,
there's a problem.
You've concussed them. If it's taking longer than that, it's like, oh yeah, you've really fucked them up and they need to go to a hospital because they probably have like internal bleeding or something.
They are not going to be okay.
Oh man. Yeah. Cause it's especially I think in movies, it's a lot easier to kind of like perceive the campiness of it.
Right.
Whereas in novels, I think you can kind of, you can hide it
get away with a little more. Yeah. It is comforting to me though that because I've heard it now from three different people. You and Alexander said it, and then Ed McDonald, who doesn't do martial arts but he does sword fighting, all said that even when you're writing, you fictionalize it a little bit. And I'm like, okay, good. That makes me feel a little bit better about because I don't.
Yeah.
I've done some kickboxing, but like I don't really do much fighting. Like I don't know what I'm doing here.
Yeah, makes the imagination can take you quite a long way.
Yeah, right. There we go.
I mean, you have to, because like, especially I've never been in a street fight, any like unsanctioned altercation. So, but I, from friends who have, like, you don't remember most of it. And actually, even my like sanctioned bouts, I don't remember. Like, if you were to describe fights on the page, it'd be like, we were talking, he threw a punch, and I was like, bro, what happened? And the cops were pulling. It's so chaotic, and it's the memory's so fractured, and it's never like this. You know, there's an elegantness in the dance to it in like a really trained environment, but a lot of it's just chaos and forgetting, yeah. Which isn't fun to read.
But you just can like slam your hands on the keyboard. Yeah.
But you can kind of mimic that a little bit, in the sense it's like dialogue in the middle of a fight is pretty, you know, like not many people would actually be thinking clearly enough to be like, oh, right. I'm going to say this to that person, or like the amount of detail that you pick up. It's like, oh shit, like I tried to get up and then I got like smacked in the back of the head, and it's like there was like stars in my eyes and I don't know what the fuck's going on. And like I hear someone shouting, someone grunting. Right. Sounds like a punch. It's like you can kind of emulate a little bit of the chaos in there without making it so
completely
bonkers or like too overly manufactured.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. That's true.
All right, buddy. Well, we'll wind down with a fun question. I know you're big into manga. I don't know how much that extends to anime as well, but what are some of your favorite manga and anime?
Oh, it's the best question I've ever been asked. This makes me so happy.
You're like, here we go. I'm ready to nerd out.
I've never been asked this question. Oh my gosh. All right. Well, let's add another half hour to the clock. I am a Attack on Titan mega fan, uber fan, super fan. In fact, I have some Attack on Titan merch almost just out of arm's reach. It was partly inspiration for the Forever Desert. You'll see it more, I think, especially in book three. I'm a huge fan. I think Fullmetal Alchemist is maybe the greatest story ever told. I just started watching Solo Leveling, a newer one. I've heard a lot about it. It should be cool if anyone's thinking of like the newer anime. I'm old, so like I'm not into Demon Slayer. I know that's like what the kids are on these days. I'm not into it. I mean, all the classics. I grew up on Dragon Ball Z, Yu Yu Hakusho, Rurouni Kenshin. Like, yeah, I've been a fan for a while. So,
which version of Fullmetal Alchemist?
Oh, no. This is the question that gets me in trouble. Oh no.
No, because I actually really love all the versions of it. I'm just really curious like, which one you like.
Everyone says Brotherhood is better.
Brotherhood?
I disagree with like every bit of fiber of my being. This is like an argument I have with all my friends for hours. They're both great. It's just a great story. But I like the original anime run better than Brotherhood.
I agree. Although I like the art style. In Brotherhood.
Brotherhood is nice, visually.
It's a very, very beautiful, beautiful anime.
If anybody wants, there's a five-hour, this is how I spend my time, there's a five-hour video dissecting Brotherhood versus the 2003 one and which one is better, and I'm just saying I'm a little bit right according to that five-hour breakdown. So.
You're like, I'm just saying, they really took their time and they studied all of the evidence and they came to my conclusion. I'm just saying.
That's all I'm saying.
Didn't take me 5 hours to get to that conclusion. It is amazing though how like deep dive people go into these kinds of things, where it's like you can just go into YouTube and find anything.
Oh, anything. Anything. Yeah.
Right. I love Some it. British dude has done all the research you need and he's gonna explain it to you. It's great.
In a great accent. Right.
Well, here's the important question though. If the Forever Desert were to be adapted, would you opt for anime or instead go for TV or film? And which one would you choose and why?
I think TV is in a golden age right now. I think this is a great time for television. I do think, though, there's certain things that can be done in animation that, like, I think I would go with animation. I mean, I would not say, you know, first of all, if anyone has money and would like to make any of these real, I'm not turning down anything. Let's do it. But, you know, if one had to happen, I think anime, just because there's like some visual set pieces and moments that I want to happen, that would just be tough live action. That's all.
Yeah. It's kind of like VFX budgets. It's very dependent.
Actor age, you get a 12-year-old actor for Tutu, or like a 17-year-old playing a 12-year-old.
A young looking 12-year-old or 17-year-old. Yeah. Well, and I think too, when you do anime or just animation in general, you get the like, I think the viewer has a little more reality suspended just because of like the medium difference. And it gives opportunity for like some of those more like emotional representations on the screen in a different way, which I think is really cool. I think I can see that working really well in an adaptation of Forever Desert. Yeah.
Agree. That's a good point.
Yeah. Because there's some very, very strong visual imagery that I think would be like, yeah, once you start to get into like the magic system and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think definitely the magic system. Also the violence. Like, yeah. You can't cut kids' tongues out, right? Like that has to be animated. I don't think you can even pretend to do that. I don't know. Like, yeah, so you know.
Now it's rated R.
Spoiler, some kids lose tongues.
Spoiler, so, yeah, there are missing tongues.
Right. There are missing tongues. They're not missing. We know where they end up.
That's true. Well, we don't at first, Adrian.
Okay. Yeah, spoiler. We find out where the tongues are.
We find the tongues.
We find the tongues. They get found, people. Come on.
If you were worried. Oh, my gosh. Well, we talked a little bit about you have book 3, obviously, in the Forever Desert series coming. But can you tell us a little? I mean, can you tell us a little bit about Forever Desert 3, if you can? If not, I understand how, like, the eyeball emoji goes on Twitter and we can't talk about it. Or, you know, can you tell us a little bit about what else you're working on or what you might be interested in working on next?
I don't know. I never know. I should start asking. I never know what I'm allowed to talk about. Like, it hasn't been announced officially, so I assume I can't announce. But I think I can safely say that, like, in the same way that book 2 builds on book 1, it'll be a similar approach to book 3. It'll be 500 years later. Yes. That's probably all I can say.
Like, that's all I know for sure that I'm allowed to say without getting into trouble. We won't get you in trouble, don't worry.
Yeah, thank you. But in terms of what I'm working on, I mean, I'm working on final revisions for that. I'm working on final revisions for the sequel to Daughters of Odumah. And then I am back to being a writer working on new stuff again. And I'm working on a few things that I'm very excited about. One of them being, hopefully, you know, like when I start a book, I'm always like, it'll be great. And then I get halfway through, I'm like, I should write a different book. This is bad. So, but right now where I'm at is that I'm working on my adult fantasy debut that I'm very excited about. And that's like really just coming together early stages. So I can't really say much, but I think it's about time. I got like a full on novel sized work. So
he's going Robert Jordan on us.
It's going to be 897 pages.
It's going to be a chonker.
No chapters, string of punches. No
chapters. Just one big. That would all be my prologue. Nightmare book.
The entire thing is prologue for any of those people out there.
Book 2 is where the story starts. Yeah.
Yeah, to be fair, I've read some series that are kind of like that, though. Honestly, and I still like them.
That's true.
Awesome, buddy. All right, well, to close out, I have a two-part question for you. If you can give listeners and viewers, A, a good bit of soundbite writing advice, and B, tell us a weird or random fact that you find to be utterly fascinating.
Oh, I was unprepared. Writing advice... okay. Oh man. Okay. I would say I've done this before, right? There's always going to be, this is not, I don't mean this cruelly. It applies to me as well. There will always be somebody who's better at writing than you are. That's just how it is. It's the nature of the game. Unless you're like Ted Chiang, then maybe there's not, but like for the most part, there will be. But the thing that you can do better than anybody, which is what you should be doing, is being yourself. And I really do think that if you write something that only you can write, something that really comes from who you are at your core, like that is the best thing you can do for yourself and for literature and for your career or whatever. Like find the things that the world needs you to say, they need you to say, not just anyone. And like, say that, I think that's the best writing advice I can offer. Also like periods, punctuate, I don't know, plenty of that stuff, but like really more important.
Dashes,
right. Yeah. Dashes. I used to read dashes. They're the absolute best punctuation mark.
Yeah.
Thank you. I agree.
And then what was it? A fact? Like a fun fact that
people
don't know? Oh, no. I'm so unprepared for this question. My brain is short-circuiting right now.
You are not alone. Adrian cruelly makes a lot of authors short circuit with this question. Like, was there anything you came across while you were doing research for any of your books that was super random? Or, yeah, I'm like trying to help you in a direction at least, because that question is so broad.
Yeah.
Random facts about cutting out tongues. No, maybe not that. Thing.
Right. If you've read The Forever Desert, there's facts. They're not fun. But I found a lot of facts that I researched. Okay, for Daughters of Oduma, there's a very, very popular form of wrestling. Senegalese, it's from Senegal, the country, a form of wrestling called La Lutte or La Am. This isn't even that fun, but they enter, so when they fight, they're huge dudes, so like 200 kilos, whatever that is in pounds. I don't know why I'm thinking in kilos right now, I'm American. But like they enter the arena and it's like them and their squad, and they're like rubbed in all these like mystical oils and like mystical clothing that's like prayed over by a native doctor to like really, you know, prepare them for the spiritual battle as well as the physical. And they come into the arena and they do this like incredible choreographed dance. Go look it up online. People know this. It's not hidden or secret, but it's really cool. Just go look it up. And like drums are pounding and trumpets are blaring and they're just like dancing. And I remember like when I was researching the book, I found like a lot of fight cultures around the world have dancing as part of the pre-fight ritual. It's very common. And it's just a really cool thing to see the different dance cultures before people go to battle. That's
very
all.
Cool.
Love it. Sorry I stumped you, buddy.
I should have been ready. Now I'm going to be paranoid about getting that question again.
Oh my god, Adrian, we should make a compilation video of all the authors that are stumped, because it's a lot. It's a lot. They're like, what?
I did an interview recently where I got asked, because the interviewer listens to the show, and they were just
for
like,
a random fact?
Writing advice and random fact. I was like, damn, that's so meta. I love it.
Right? I love it. And were you stumped? The only reason why I wasn't stumped when you interviewed me was because I'm on the show and I knew you were going to ask me, so yeah. I researched one beforehand. But I would have had no idea what to say.
No, I mean, mine was it was obviously about mushrooms. So
I was literally just going to say, if your fact wasn't about mushrooms, I'm going to be so disappointed in you, Adrian. Okay.
You will not be disappointed. All right. Well, Moses, thank you so much for chatting with MJ and I today. Also, for anyone who contributes to our Patreon at $10 or more each month, you can hear an exclusive reading by Moses from The Truth of the Eleke. Moses, thanks for hanging out with us, buddy. I really appreciate it.
Oh, thank you. This was awesome. Appreciate it.
Could you please let everyone know where they can find you online?
Yeah. I have my website, MosesOseyotomi.com. I'm also on Twitter. I'm recently on Blue Sky. For Twitter and Blue Sky, I'm at Moses Otomi, I think, at Moses Oseyotomi. And then on Instagram, I'm at Professor Sequel. It doesn't make any sense, but it's Prof Sequel, ProfSequill. You can just Google and find me on social media. I'm all around.
Being all fucking cool and stuff on Instagram.
I'm very uncool, man. Instagram is, I haven't figured that game out yet.
All right. You can also follow SFF Addicts on Instagram, Twitter, Threads, Blue Sky, all that stuff at SFF Addicts Pod. You can follow me at Adrian M. Gibson. MJ, where can people find you?
Yeah, you can find me across all the major socials at MJ Kuhn Books, all one word, or just my website, mjkuhn.com. All the links are there.
And you can go sign up for MJ's newsletter, get a free story. You can go buy her books, these little bebes, and support her amazing work. And that's it for this episode. Stay tuned next week for part two with Moses for our mini master class on circular storytelling. Now, keep reading, keep imagining, and we'll see you next time on SFF Addicts.